To speak of scientific management in school and society without crediting the influence of the Fabians would do great disservice to truth. But the nature of Fabianism is so complex it raises questions this essay cannot answer. To deal with the Fabians in a brief compass, as I'm going to do, is to deal necessarily in simplifications in order to see how little this charming group of scholars, writers, heirs, heiresses, scientists, philosophers, bombazines, gazebos, trust fund babies, and successful men and women of affairs became the most potent force in the creation of the modern welfare state, distributors of its characteristically dumbed-down version of schooling. Yet pointing only to this frivolous organization's eccentricity would be to disrespect the incredible accomplishments of Beatrice Webb and her associates and their decisive effort on schooling. Mrs. Webb is the only woman ever deemed worthy of burial in Westminster Abbey. What 19th-century transcendentalists and Muggletonians hoped to be in reordering the triumvirate of society, school, and family, 20th-century Fabians actually were. Although far from the only potent organization working behind the scenes to radically reshape domestic and international life, it would not be too far out of line to call the 20th century the Fabian century. One thing is certain, the direction of modern schooling for the bottom 90% of our society has followed a largely Fabian design. And the puzzling security and prestige enjoyed at the moment by those who speak of globalism and multiculturalism are a direct result of heed paid earlier to Fabian prophecies that a welfare state, followed by an intense focus on internationalism, would be the mechanism elevating corporate society over political society and a necessary precursor to utopia. Fabian theory is the Das Kapital of financial capitalism. Fabianism always floated above simplistic politics, seeking to preempt both sides. The British Labour Party and its post-World War II welfare state are Fabianism made visible. This is well understood. Not so easily comprehended are the signs of an aristocratic temper, like this little anti-merocratic Fabian gem found in a report of the British College of Surgeons. Quote, "Medicine would lose immeasurably if the proportion of such students from upper-class and upper-middle-class homes were to be reduced in favor of precocious children who qualify for subsidies, i.e. scholarship students." Even though meritocracy is their reliable cover, social stratification was always the Fabians' real trump suit. Entitlements are another Fabian insertion into the social fabric, even though the idea antedates them, of course. To realize the tremendous task Fabians originally assigned themselves, a significant part of which was given to schooling reform, we need to reflect again on Darwin's shattering books, The Origin of Species in 1859 and The Descent of Man in 1871, each arguing in its own way that far from being blank slates, children are written upon indelibly by their race of origin, some favored in Darwin's language, some not. A powerful public relations initiative of recent years has attempted to separate Darwin from social Darwinism, but it cannot be done because Darwin himself is the prototypical social Darwinist. Both books taken together issued a license for liberal upper classes to justify forced schooling. From an evolutionary perspective, schools are the indoctrination phase of a gigantic breeding experiment. Working-class fantasies of self-improvement were dismissed from the start as sentimentality that evolutionary theory had no place for. What Darwin accomplished with his books was a freeing of discussion from the narrow straitjacket it had worn when society was considered a matter of internal associations and relationships. Darwin made it possible to consider political affairs as a prime instrument of social evolution. Here was a pivotal moment in Western thought, a changing of the guard in which secular purpose replaced religious purpose, long before trashed by the Enlightenment. For the poor, the working classes, and middle classes in the American sense, This change in outlook, lauded by the most influential minds of the 19th century, were a catastrophe of titanic proportions, especially for government school children. Children could no longer simply be parents' darlings. Many were biologically a racial menace. The rest had to be thought of as soldiers in genetic combat, the moral equivalent of war. For all but a relative handful of favored families, aspiration was off the board as a scientific proposition. For governments, children could no longer be considered individuals, but were regarded as categories, rungs on a biological ladder. Evolutionary science pronounced the majority useless mouths waiting for nature to dispense with entirely. Nature, as expressed through her human agents, was to be understood not as cruel or oppressive, but beautifully, functionally purposeful, a neo-pagan perspective to be reflected in the organization and administration of schools. Three distinct and conflicting tendencies competed in the 19th century theory of society. First was the empirical tendency stemming from John Locke and David Hume, which led to that outlook on the study of society we call pragmatism, and eventually to behavioristic psychology. The second line, descended from Immanuel Kant, Hegel, Savigny, and others, led to the organic theory of the modern state, the preferred metaphor of Fabian's and many later systems theorists. The third outlook comes to us out of Rousseau, Diderot, D'Alembert, Bentham, and the Mills, and leads almost directly to the utilitarian state of Marxist socialism. Each of these postures was savagely assailed over time by the development of academic Darwinism. After Darwin, utopia as a human-friendly place dies an agonizing death. The last conception of utopia after Darwin, which isn't some kind of hellish nightmare, is William Morris' News from Nowhere. With only niggling reservations, the Fabian Brain Trust had no difficulty employing force to shape recalcitrant individuals, groups, and organizations. Force, in the absence of divine injunctions, is a tool to be employed unsentimentally. Fabian George Bernard Shaw established the principle wittily in 1920 when he said that under a Fabian future government, quote, you would not be allowed to be poor. You would be forcibly fed, clothed, lodged, taught, and employed whether you liked it or not. If it were discovered that you have not character and industry, you might possibly be executed in a kindly manner. From The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism and Capitalism. Fabianism came into existence around the year 1884, taking its name from the Roman general Fabius Cunctator, who preserved the Roman state by defeating Hannibal, chipping away at Hannibal's patience and will to win by avoiding combat. Darwin was the weird holy man Fabians adored, the man who gave them their principle, a theory inspirationally equal to God theory, around which a new organization of society could be justified. Society after Darwin was incontrovertibly about good breeding. That was the only true goal it had, or scientifically could have. Before Darwin, the view of historical development, which fit best with Anglo-American tradition, was a conception of individual rights independent of any theory of reciprocal obligations to the state. The duty of leaders was to society, not to government, a crucial distinction in perfect harmony with the teachings of Reformation Christianity, which extended to all believers a conception of individual duty, individual responsibility, and a free will to decide for oneself beyond any claims of states. John Calvin proclaimed in his Institutes that through natural law, the judgment of conscience alone was able to distinguish between justice and injustice. It's hard for secular minds to face, but the powerful freedoms of the West, unmatched by any other society at any other time, are rooted deeply in a religion so radical, so demanding, it revolts the modern temper. For Protestant Christians, salvation was uniquely a matter between God and the individual. The mind of Northern Europe had for centuries been fixed on the task of winning liberties for the individual against the state. Notable individual freedoms were taken from the state, beginning symbolically at Runnymede in 1215. By 1859, 6.5 centuries later, in the age of Darwin, individual rights were everywhere in the Anglo-Saxon world, understood to transcend theories of obligation to the state. Herbert Spencer embodies this attitude, albeit ambiguously. For Spencer, Darwinian evolution promised rights only to the strong. It is well to keep in mind that his brief for liberty masks a rigorously exclusionary philosophy, particularly when he sounds most like Thomas Paine. The First and Second Amendments of our own Constitution illustrate just how far this freedom process could carry. Say what you please before God and man. Protect yourself with a gun if need be from government interference. Spencer was the reigning British philosopher from 1870 to 1900. In the Westminster Review of January 1860, he wrote, "The welfare of citizens cannot rightly be sacrificed to some supposed benefit of the state. The state is to be maintained solely for the benefit of the citizens. The corporate life in society must be subservient to the lives of its parts, instead of the lives of the parts being subservient to the corporate life." Spencer had an even greater vogue in America, influencing every intellectual from Walt Whitman to John Dewey, and becoming the darling of corporate business. Early in 1882, a grand dinner was held in his honor by the great and powerful who gathered to hear scientific proof of Anglo-Saxon fitness to rule, and a brief for moral relativism. The dinner and its implications set the standard for 20th century management, including the management of schooling. A clear appraisal of the fateful meal and its resonance is given in E. Digby Baltzel's The Protestant Establishment, a well-bred look at the resurgence of the Anglican outlook in America. This attitude constituted a violent contradiction of German strong state, state as parent doctrine, which held that interests of the individual as individual are without significance. But the derogation of individual rights was entirely consistent with Darwinian science. The German authoritarian preference received an invigorative restorative with Darwin's advent. Natural selection, the operational principle of Darwinism, was held to reach individuals only indirectly through the action of society. Hence, society becomes a natural subject for regulation and intervention by the state. To illustrate how reverberant a drum the innocent-sounding locution natural selection can really be translated into social practice, try to imagine how denial of black dignities and rights and the corresponding degradation of black family relationships in America because of this denial might well be reckoned an evolutionary positive course in Darwinian terms. By discouraging Negro breeding, eventually the members of this most disfavored race would diminish. The state not only had a vested interest in becoming an active agent of evolution, it could not help but become one willy-nilly. Fabians set out to write a sensible evolutionary agenda when they entered the political arena. Once this biopolitical connection is recognized, the past, present, and future of this seemingly bumbling movement takes on a formidable coherence. Under the dottiness, lovability, intelligence, high social position, and genuine goodness of some of their works, the system held out as humanitarian by Fabians is grotesquely deceptive in reality. Fabian compassion masks a real aloofness to humanity. It is a purely intellectual project in scientific management. Thomas Davidson's History of Education, seen through this lens, transmutes in front of our eyes from the harmlessly addled excursion into romantic futurism, it seems to be, into a manual of frightening strategic goals and tactical methods. Fabians emerged in the first years of the 20th century as great champions of social efficiency in the name of the evolutionary destiny of the race. This infused a powerful secular theology into the movement, allowing its members to revel privately in an ennobling destiny. The Fabian program spread quickly through the best colleges and universities under many different names, multiplying its de facto membership among young men and women blissfully unaware of their induction. They were only being modern. H.G. Wells called it the open conspiracy in an essay bearing the same title, and worth your time to track down. As the movement developed, Fabians became aristocratic friends of other social efficiency vanguards like Taylorism, or allies of the Methodist social gospel crowd of liberal Christian religionists, busy substituting works for faith in one of the most noteworthy religious reversals of all time. Especially, they became friends and advisors of industrialists and financiers, travelers in the same direction. This cross-fertilization occurred naturally, not out of petty motives of profit, but because by Fabian lights, evolution had progressed furthest among the international business and banking classes. These laughing gentry were impressively effective at whatever they turned their hands to because they understood the principles of social leverage. Kitty Muggeridge writes, "If you want to pinpoint the moment in time when the very first foundation of the welfare state was laid, a reasonable date to choose would be the last fortnight of November in 1905, when Beatrice Webb was appointed to the Royal Commission on the Poor Law. And she convinced her protege, Albert Beveridge, to join a committee for dealing with employment. During Mrs. Webb's tenure on the Royal Commission, she laid down the first blueprint of cradle-to-grave social security to eradicate poverty without toppling the whole social structure. She lived to see Beveridge promulgate her major ideas in the historic Beveridge Report, from which they were brought to life in post-World War II Britain and the United States. Fabian practitioners developed Hegelian principles, which they co-taught alongside Morgan bankers and other important financial allies over the first half of the 20th century. One insightful Hegelianism was that to push ideas efficiently, it was first necessary to co-opt both political left and political right. Adversarial politics, competition was a loser's game. By infiltrating all major media, by continual low-intensity propaganda, by massive changes in group orientations, accomplished through principles developed in the psychological warfare bureaus of the military, and with the ability, using government intelligence agents and press contacts, to induce a succession of crises, they accomplished that astonishing feat.